Welcome to Lives in Leadership. This podcast is dedicated to promoting thoughtful and strategic conversations about military leadership, ethics, culture, and service in the profession of arms within the Australian Defence Force. My name is Dr. Lucas Murray, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Warrant Officer Dave Ashley. Dave's career in the Australian Army spans more than four decades. He enlisted back in 1979 and went on to serve across a range of battalions and formations, including 1 RAR, 6 RAR and 3 Brigade. He's had operational deployments to Southeast Asia, East Timor, Timor-Leste and Afghanistan. Dave has held some of the most senior appointments, including Command Sergeant Major of Forces Command and Regimental Sergeant Major RSM of the Army from 2011 to 2015. Dave's recognised with the Medal of the Order of Australia and a member of the Order of Australia, and his service reflects an enduring commitment to outstanding leadership, professionalism, and the ongoing development of the modern soldier. Dave Ashley, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Dave. Dave, could you perhaps just briefly explain to our audience what is a warrant officer? You're the first warrant officer we've had on the program. And can you explain what they are, what they do in the ADF?
Well, it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
And it's based on tradition. But a warrant officer is an officer by virtue of a warrant rather than a King's Commission. And the Defence Force is quite unique. You've got a route of advancement for officers and the parallel route of advancement for enlisted leaders. A warrant officer is basically the senior enlisted leader. And what does a warrant officer do? Advises. In fact, I reflected on what the role of the regimental sergeant major is, which is a form of warrant officer for the Army. And it was to provide a unique and particular perspective to the commander's decision-making process and to represent and invest in the human dimension of capability. It's about the people, particularly the NCOs.
Wonderful. Oh, thanks for joining us, Dave, and it's great to have you on the program. When I was reading out your resume, I guess you've served in a range of different roles as a warrant officer, as we said, from battalion-level appointments through to RSM, as you just described, of the Army. How did your perspective on leadership evolve as you moved through those levels of responsibility?
Well, here I'll talk about my own input, if I could. And I'm not going to say that a battalion-level operation is just a tactical thing, it's operational. But my input into it was tactical. So here's the difference between the different levels of RSM. Tier A, unit level. Tier D, RSM of the Army. For example, when I was the RSM of the 6th Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment, that was a unit level Tier A appointment. And my and we deployed to East Timor in 2000. My focus was 95% on the tactical, soldier standards, leadership standards, things like that. 4% was on the operation. So tactical is 6 RAR's operations as part of the wider operation down on the border with Indonesia. The operational part of it was the operations of the entire peacekeeping force. Well, I was interested in that about 4% of the time only, particularly with the New Zealanders who shared a boundary with us. And the strategic part of it, well, we were bringing into existence the first new nation of the 21st century. That's a strategic thing. And I could use that to motivate my soldiers. That's what we have to live up to. But then I became a Tier B warrant officer. For example, I was the RSM of the 3rd Brigade and we went back to Timor in 2006. This time I had a different focus on the operational, more operational focus, because part of our Joint Task Force 631 included Battle Group Faithful, which had its own RSM, Grant McFarland, who is also a member of CDLE and commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Mick Mumford. I was there in support, but I left him alone. But in the operational sense, I had to do things and put inputs in to tie the force together. We had a Malaysian contingent, a New Zealand contingent. We had aviators. We had the Navy and the Air Force. So my focus was different. And when I became a more senior RSM, a Tier C or Tier D, particularly RSM of the Army, it was strategic. Yes, I was very interested in the tactical, very interested in the operational, but my role was about over the horizon. What challenges would face the Army in 10, 20 or 30 years' time? Were we enlisting the right people? Were we training them correctly? Were we developing them correctly? How do we raise, train and sustain the force in the future? So that, I think, is the difference in the different levels of RSMs I served in.
Well, that's a great context for a discussion on leadership across those levels. I think what's interesting to me is that you described a lot about the role itself and what kind of responsibilities you have at those different levels. But how did you as a leader change between, you know, those sorts of appointments? Like, was there different kind of ways in which you communicated with, you know, the unit or the commander that you're dealing with? Or the things that you learnt along the way that perhaps changed or stayed the same?
They basically stayed the same. I'll say it again. The role of the RSM at every level is to provide that unique and particular perspective to the commander's decision-making process, whether it's a commanding officer of a unit or the chief of army, and to represent and invest in the human dimension of capability. It's about people, whether it's at a unit, a brigade, a division, a command, or the army.
Wonderful. And so what does leadership, in its simplest form, what does it mean to you?
The best leaders, doesn't matter if they're lieutenant colonels or lieutenant generals, always knew it was not about them, but rather the sum of the team they led, the people. And here some of them talking S-U-M. In other words, it was about their people. They knew they were nothing without the sum of their team. And I think to an extent, the very few leaders that came up short, and I'm happy to say that we have far more good leaders than bad leaders. The ones that come up short were more focused on themselves. So the good leaders, which were the effective leaders, trained their people well, trusted them with validation. So not blind trust. Validation is just asking questions, doing battlefield circulations, having an inquiring mind, taking the vibe of the unit. And their sergeant major is essential to that, to assist them to do that. They accepted that mistakes will sometimes occur, as always happens in human-based teams. They learned as a team from those mistakes and experiences, and they and the unit formation or even the army just got better and better. And the best leaders were inclusive. They would include those they led wherever possible, even if it was just asking them, what do you think? And I think if a leader sets this environment and way of doing business, their people will respond with unity or purpose and willing cooperation. So the boss's plan becomes their plan and the boss's aims become their aims. So take a unit level, for instance. In a unit with 500 humans working together in willing cooperation who will create mission success because they're well-trained, trusted and valued. And this will beat the individual every single time. And the leader just can't tell his or her subordinates to work in unity or work as a team. They have to personally lead it. Now, I'll give you an example. It's an example from my very early past. I was a corporal in 1RAR. My platoon commander was Lieutenant John Caligari. He's well known to your listeners. He retired as a lieutenant general. When he joined the platoon, he said, I don't command and lead your sections. You do. I do it through you. Now, sometimes he had to make an instant decision, which you have to in war. You have to in training. You've got no time. But wherever possible, he asked us what we think, what we thought, I should say. He listened to what we had to say. He gave us feedback. He got a bit from me, a bit from them, a bit from himself. And before you knew it, his plan was our plan. So we were able to sell it to our teams. It was really easy to write and give orders afterwards as well. That's an example of an inclusive, great leader. The fact that he made Lieutenant General is proof of that.
That's a wonderful answer. And I like how you've described maybe how what that looks like in practice or some of the qualities of a good leader. It makes me think about a conversation that we've had off mic before about, you know, what makes a leader unique within the Australian Defence Force compared to other organisations. Are there things from your experience, whether it's, you know, as a senior enlisted or the leaders you've seen, you know, who are commissioned, that there's qualities or attributes or practices that they have that make them that make leadership different within this organisation?
It's care for the troops. I believe strongly that the ADF is a unique organisation. I'm not saying we're all the only organisation where there's massive stress, but we are the only organisation in the land that can be authorised within the laws of armed conflict to take the life of another human being against their will. The police can't do it. Doctors can't do it. And this burden falls on the shoulders of predominantly young people. Then there's a unique type of leadership required for that.
And you said earlier it's about care for people having to do that role. Is that what you meant by care of them? Kind of understanding the context of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll give you an example. The death or wounding of a mate has a severe impact on the force. So I remember every second of every day in East Timor when Corporal Monster Jones was killed in action.
Can you describe who that was?
Corporal Monster Jones was an Armoured Corps soldier posted to 6th Battalion, and he was killed in operations in East Timor. It had a severe effect on me. You can imagine the effect it would have had on his mates. I remember in Afghanistan, even though I was one level detached from this, they were still in what the Americans call the battle space, still there. The deaths of Corporal Richard Atkinson, Sapper Jamie Larkham, Lance Corporal Andrew Jones, Sergeant Brett Wood, Lieutenant Marcus Case. I felt that. To get a soldier and a unit through those deaths takes a special form of leadership. That's just one example of the burdens that are placed on leadership in the ADF.
It's interesting to think about because I think you're right. There is a unique context. I mean, I think a lot of organisations have unique contexts. I've spoke to you, but in the past I've worked for emergency services and it's a pretty unique context. You know, oh, yeah. I'm not saying it's the same as the ADF, not at all. But it requires a different sort of leader there than it does.
It's going to get worse and worse because take Afghanistan or the Middle East generally, we had 41 people killed in action in 10 years. We had several hundred wounded and thousands more affected in other ways. In a war with our next adversary, we could have 41 people killed in a minute. Killed in a minute. So in our ever softer society, how can we build into our people, through leadership, the resilience to withstand the rigors of war and combat? But as a leader, you need to be there with them and for them. You need to get out of the command post and get into their shoes from things like battlefield circulation, which is hard to do in war because there's a massive overhead to it, but you need to do it. You've got to insist on hard, realistic training and don't compromise on physical and moral standards. You know, we talk about standards all the time. There is only one standard demanded by combat, and that is the standard required for combat because for absolute certain, the enemy are not going to give a discount.
You said in the beginning of that answer, and I really like what you said, but you did say that in an ever softer society, do you feel like we're living in a society now that is a bit, as you said, soft?
Oh, we are. I'm an old man, 66 years old. I remember when I was a kid, we used to walk to school, pedal bikes. It's all electric pad bikes now. We used to be able to withstand rigors. I don't think society can withstand now. It doesn't mean that we can't get ready for war. We can. We just have to remember, I think personally, the gap is greater.
Mm. Interesting. I would say I respectfully disagree. I think we do live in a society that's dealing with a lot of global sort of turmoil, whether it's a financial, you know, comfortability that used to be there.
There's no reason we can't train them to be tough and resilient. We've just got to train them to be tough and resilient. We just can't say we're just going to take you straight off the street and throw you into the battle space. It doesn't work that way. There's a burden on leadership.
Yeah, and the ADF is going through different ways to try to recruit different, like, you know, wider parts of our society. And it's interesting the way it goes about doing that or who it targets or kind of, like you said, what kinds of environments are we putting young people into and are we prepared and are we training them correctly for that environment?
And we can if the trainers, but you know, the only thing that we need for service in the ADF is a love of country. Someone who's prepared, who loves our country and is prepared to put up their right hand and say, I, the person described in this form, do swear or affirm. Then it's up to us to train them for war.
Talking a little bit about war, you know, you've already mentioned about East Timor and Afghanistan, that you were deployed to those countries. What leadership lessons stand out from those operational environments to you, Dave?
Well, we've just got to remember that war is a brutal place and it's very human. Again, it goes to that human dimension of capability I mentioned before. And I've spoken already about the death or wounding of a mate, the fact that we have to endure, and we have to take, unfortunately, human life within the laws of armed conflict and do it in a way that minimises collateral damage.
And so can I ask a little bit about what you've talked about human a few times and you've talked about it early on, it was about care. For understanding your people, what does it mean for you in this sort of context?
It's your team. You've got to care for your own troops, but you've also got to care for non-combatants and you've got to care for the enemy as well. The rules of engagement, the laws of armed conflict, the Geneva Convention, it's care for everyone in the battle space.
Are there any other lessons from those operational environments, like specific ones that you experienced, perhaps a memory of it or a particular moment that kind of comes to mind when you think about challenges in those environments?
Well, we talk about preparing our troops for war. And for me, as the RSM, it's the human dimension of capability, particularly the NCOs. So one of the things we talked about before was how can Army best develop leadership among junior NCOs and soldiers today? I think it goes to your question. It's simplistic, but we need to understand what a future battle space will look like. And we need to prepare our junior leaders to face that challenge. And junior NCOs are not our only junior leaders. I think from the Army context, junior leadership is leadership in the platoon or troop space, the lieutenant, the sergeant, and the corporal. And if a lieutenant acts like he's a general, by the way, or if a lieutenant acts like she's a general when they're a lieutenant, they're likely to become a cropper. So if they get it right in the junior leader space, because more senior leadership are guiding them and developing them, one day they may become that general. We also need to unshackle our junior leaders as much as possible from tasks and responsibilities that take them away from war fighting or training for it. The platoon sergeant, for instance, should be training the platoon for war, not bogged down with matters not related to beating the enemy on the battlefield. And I just want to say about the importance of the NCO Corps, if I can. The hallmark of any professional force that can win is an enabled and professional NCO Corps. That's it. You see this between Russia and Ukraine. Now, the Russians don't have an NCO Corps and they're getting hammered on the battlefield because the junior leader and the RSM's got a responsibility to develop that junior leader. They're the ones with the lieutenants and sergeants that turn orders into action. You can give all the orders you like. If you don't have anyone to turn into action, you're probably going to fail.
So this is a question I haven't asked, but you went to it about how the Army can best develop leadership amongst its junior NCOs and soldiers. And I think it's a good question.
And if I can keep going.
Go for it. Yeah.
I think it's called the drums of war. They're beating. And a war with our next enemy will be a total war. Very different from East Timor, Iraq and Afghanistan. Not just the casualties that we may face. The next war may have very more dimensions. Outer space, deep underwater, land, sea and air, cyber, weapons of mass destruction, but there'll still be a place for the bayonet. We've seen that in the war between Russia and Ukraine. And as we've seen with Russia and Ukraine, or with Israel and Hamas for that reason, war still involves much death and destruction for both combatants and non-combatants. The next war will also be characterised by much uncertainty and what they call it the fog of war. So we need to teach and enable our junior leaders to think and act for their small teams because we won't have any communications or access to resupply. So right now we have soldiers that might say, well, I've got a ration pack. I don't eat half of them, I'm going to leave it behind. They can't do that because one day that fruit bar that they can't stand might end up being their rations for an entire day. If the platoon sergeant can find just a bit of space to put one more belt of ammunition in, it could make all the difference in the future. So we need to teach and enable our junior leaders to think and act for their small teams, and we must train and enable them and exercise them to be brilliant at the basics. Now, that is an aspirational thing because I've never met a brilliant soldier and I've never met a brilliant person. You come close, though. But we need to get as close as possible. For example, we've got a lot of technology now, and I'll give you one example of technology, global positioning systems. Last time I went field, only last year, I still occasionally go out and see the soldiers. I've got a wrist-held global positioning system. Look at it. It tells me where I am. I want to go somewhere, I just feed in the coordinates, it tells me how to get there. No GPS, we've got no satellites, taken out from the enemy. We've got no GPS, I've still got to go back and then use a resection, just like I'm taught in basic training, to find my location. I've got to be able to read a map, set a bearing on my compass and choose a route to get me to my next objective. Night vision goggles, we're running our batteries and because there's no resupply, we've got to be able to operate at night without those. We've got to be brilliant at the basics or as close as we can. And so our training then, particularly our exercises, need to simulate this uncertainty. The company quartermaster sergeant in war is unlikely to resupply you with fresh water every 24 hours. He drives on the road, he's going to be targeted and there'll be no portaloos. So we've got to go back to digging field latrines just like we did in World War Bloody One. And regardless of so-called technology, but we need to embrace it as it helps us prevail on the battlefield, I'll say it again. This is about toughness. There's still a need for the bayonet.
And when you say a need for the bayonet, do you really mean that there's still a need for Army particularly, because you did mention about Army training or Army leadership, to focus perhaps on a sort of ground offensive as a primary?
Of course.
Yeah. Because you did mention as well. And we are on an island state.
We change things all the time. Yeah. I'm an infantry soldier in the army, and I don't know how this comment will be taken by others. I think it was in 1947 we developed a thing called the role of infantry: to seek out and close with the enemy, to kill or capture him, to seize and hold ground, and repel attack by day or night, regardless of season, weather or terrain. I'm probably the only person being interviewed on this who's ever said the word kill, by the way. That's what we bloody do within the laws of armed conflict. We close with the enemy and kill him. We may have to use a bayonet in the future. I'll tell you a story. When I was RSM of the army, a CO wanted to stop bayonet fighting because the CO believed it was teaching aggression. You can't win in a war unless you're aggressive, but it's controlled, legal, ethical aggression. We've got to know the difference.
I don't disagree with that, but it's interesting because you made the point earlier, and I think it's a good one, about the changing nature of modern warfare. And we are in Australia. We're not on, like, in the North European continent where some of our adversaries are on the same kind of land continent as us. And in a way, it's interesting in this modern environment, which you did say, cyber, space, other sorts of maybe attacks that we should be prepared for. Do you think the army having this identity of a ground offensive makes it challenging for them to adapt to a more modern, contemporary warfighting?
No, we're showing adaption all the time. We just got to remember our basics. There's only one thing certain about the next war, and that thing is that we don't know anything for certain. The idea that we won't end up on a Pacific island face to face with an enemy, we run out of ammunition and we have to draw our bayonets, it could happen. So we need to train for it. That role of infantry I read out before could be the role of the Defence Force. That's what we do.
Right.
An enemy fleet, we seek out and close with that fleet.
Yeah.
We destroy that fleet.
I guess, and I'm not an ADF member, and I come from the outside a little bit. I'd be worried that if we spent too long training men and women with the bayonet, that we're not training them for the more likelihood of, say, a cyber kind of war or a war that looks differently.
I'd say this. If we unshackle our leadership from things not pertaining to war fighting, we'd have time for everything.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on what, because I was thinking of that, of the war fighting context of that.
Yeah, the drums of war are beating. We have to prepare for the next war now. But the idea that you can say the next war won't include a bayonet, we're not going to train in bayonet fighting. If you get the basics right, you can do everything. But if you just focus on one area and then you need to go back to the basics, you won't have it. So the idea being, we've got global positioning systems, we no longer have to teach navigation. That is ludicrous. Just remember our basics, because if we get the basics right, everything else will fall into place. And I know the audience is probably colonels and brigadiers and all that. That's the environment you set. Get the basics right. Be brilliant at the basics, whether you're in the Navy, the Army or the Air Force.
You joined in 1979, as I read it earlier, and it's a very different army than the one that perhaps exists today. What cultural shifts stand out most to you from your journey, better or worse, really?
Well, much is also the same. War is still kill or be killed. We're seeing that right around the world now. It's kill or be killed. But I think today there's a lot more for the junior leader in particular to consider. Far more. When I was a corporal in 1RAR, for instance, the 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, I had to know my shit, in other words, be technically proficient, be fit, and be aggressive. We expect so much more of our people these days. Technology, the use of autonomous systems to inflict lethal effects on the enemy or on us as well, such as drones, and in particular, the changing face of the ADF. When I joined the army in 1979, we were a white, Christian, male, Anglo-Saxon army. We had some great Indigenous soldiers. We had the Women's Royal Australian Army Corps. But now we more reflect the changing face of our nation, and we should embrace that. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. I'll give you an example. I've just attended the CDF NCO Leadership Forum, and I met an army corporal from Nepal and an Air Force corporal from China. Straight away, what does that give us? Two sets of language capabilities. But the challenge now is, how, for instance, can we provide chaplaincy support to a defence force that comes from all around the world with all these different religious backgrounds? Can we do that? We've got to make sure that when we have, I spoke about Russian PACs before, that we have ration packs that everybody can eat. It's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. But if we embrace that, we embrace the face of Australia, that comes with huge human capability, and our leaders must accept that. That's a good thing. The other thing too, there's more of a 24-hour battlefield now. In 1979, we used to patrol. Come dark, we'd go into a harbour, which is like a defensive position. These days, we're 24-7. So this is not really about answering your cultural thing, but this 24-hour battlefield means that we have to manage fatigue. We have an exercise. You go out for 7 days. You know you're coming back on Sunday. A war ends when it ends. It can last for months. So there's a huge, that's just another example of the burdens and responsibilities put on the junior leader of today that may not have been on the junior leader.
And I think it is a cultural difference, actually, like a difference of a more modern time, which definitely is a different sort of defence culture today that people have to work and.
You know, I'll tell you another story if I can.
Yeah, go for it.
One of the reasons, I didn't join the army for this reason, but I realised it was one of the reasons I was staying in the army. I'm an immigrant myself, and my family ran from basically poverty in the UK. We came out here in 1962. I was really proud to serve because I was paying this beautiful country back for the generosity given to me and my family. I visited headquarters, one Australian division in the field last year, and I met another corporal who was a refugee saved by Australia, and that person was paying Australia back. And we're getting all those cultural skills, the language skills. It's a great story, I reckon.
And you're right, there is more roles for women, there's more roles for Indigenous Australians, there's more roles for different nationalities who perhaps have got residency in this country recently. I know there was a recent change to enrolments. Has this also changed, like you said, the ADF culture, the differences of diversity of opinions, like you said, languages, food? Are there other things that have changed from that influx?
Of course, we've changed our uniforms.
Right.
50% of our nation are women. So if we block off recruiting from all parts of Australia, we're blocking off what we actually need to defend our country in the future. Because our recruiting base, if we just stick to people like Dave Ashley, is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. There's still a role for a Dave Ashley, don't get me wrong, but there's actually a role for every Australian. As I said, all they need is a love of country, a genuine love of country. We will do the rest.
Can I ask you what that means? Love of country has always been hard for me. I was born in Australia. My mum was born in Singapore. My dad was born in England. But I've never felt a strong sense of nationalism to the country, and it's because sometimes I've always found it complicated to feel a strong sense of nationalism to Australia, because Australia has never often been a place that I've often felt wholly welcome. You know, I was born here.
You just said something.
Yeah.
That I think it was bad that you said it.
Okay, what did I say?
You said about being Australian, never felt a love of country. You've never been nationalism. Nationalism is a dirty word now. People associate it with right wing. It's not. Put it this way, Lucas. If an enemy attacked our country and were killing our people, would you fight for our country? Would you stand up and fight for our country, even if it's doing what you're doing right now in defence?
Right, yes. I think I do have an identity.
Then, Lucas, you love our country.
Right, but I also feel it's complicated, and it's what I was trying to get to. I do feel I am an Australian. You know, I'm a part of this country. It's my identity, particularly when I'm outside of Australia and I feel more Australian. But I also feel that Australia, I don't really know exactly who it's for, and I've often felt a little bit on the outside, and it's a complicated one, a feeling, oh, I'm going to sign up because I feel this strong sense of pride, in the same way that perhaps you do, Dave.
Well, it's about the community of nations.
Right.
Well, go back to Timor when we went there. Remember I said bring the first new nation of the 21st century into existence? And right now, right, another burden, I want to say this, so I'll probably get off the track a bit. We expect a lot more from our people now because, and based on what we did with the Australian Army training team in Vietnam, in the last quarter of a century, we have trained and mentored the East Timorese, the Iraqis, the Afghans, the Filipinos, lots of countries in our region. Right now we're in the United Kingdom training Ukrainian soldiers. We are here for everyone. We've saved more lives than we've ever taken through the things that we do with natural disasters and search and rescue. So if you put your hand up and say, I love my country, I'm going to join the ADF, you pay that love back by helping someone out who's a victim of a flood.
Perhaps it's maybe just because of, you know, coming being a sort of first-generation Australian to the country, that I feel I'm unsure of what the country is. But also, you know, our past sort of colonial history is something that, you know, I understand is a part of our history, but it also makes me feel a bit, not a little ashamed sometimes to be part of the history of this country that's had that sort of impact on Indigenous Australians. And so I sort of wrestle with that tension and with also having a sort of love and strong identity to the country. And so that sort of complicates my feeling of national pride. Anyway, I'll leave it there because it's feels a little personal going into that. But I think a lot of Australians who perhaps maybe my generation or feel the same way that I do have still love for the country, but it's a complicated love.
I love this country and I've fought for this country and I'll continue to fight this country. But also I feel ashamed when we've got, you sit on Sydney Harbour and see those mega yachts and mansions and you go, what a great country. Well, in the outback, we've got Aboriginal communities, Indigenous communities doing it tough. That couldn't be right. We've got things to fix. Just because they're there doesn't mean we can't love our country.
Yeah.
I would fight for my country. And
that's a good point.
Part of being tough is being prepared to fight for your country. You fight for your family, you fight for your country. We're probably getting off. Let's keep going.
It's interesting conversation. It's good. Dave, every leader makes mistakes along the way. Is there a moment or decision that you look back on that didn't go as planned? And can you tell us what you perhaps learned from that experience?
If I told you every mistake I'd ever made, we'd be here until Christmas next year. But nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'll make a mistake today. You find out afterwards, someone tells you or you realise it. There's two things that I would do differently. So fundamentally, one is I would take more time to make a decision to say something or to omit to do something. I would put myself in the shoes of those that I led. How would they think? What will their reaction be to what I'm about to say or do? And if I understood that, I reckon I would have made better decisions and made far less mistakes. The other thing I would have done is kept a journal, a personal journal, not one on that can, not an official one. I would every single day sit down and write, what did I learn today? What are my sustains? What are my improves? What are my fixes? And that would have made me a far better enlisted leader than I actually was. So they're the two things I would do that I would do differently. But I've made countless mistakes. Everybody has made countless mistakes. But you know what? It's what you do about those mistakes that count. It's rectifying the mistake. Not saying sorry every 2 seconds, but actually showing a commitment to making yourself better and to remediating any damage that you may have caused.
I think reflection can be really hard, and I like what you said. I think having a practice, whether it's journaling or speaking to someone or even some other processes that you might have to reflect on how to do things better, I think is really important. And I like the curiosity that you have to think, oh, I can't just say sorry and get over it, but I have to think about in the future when I will make that mistake again or other mistakes, how do I improve? Thinking of it as self-development or a sort of an ongoing journey, I think is really important. And well said, Dave. And it's been great having you on the show and I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Dave.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial no derivatives 4.0 international license. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting d.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.